Welcome back, friends. It's time for the next episode in the Balticon 46 wrap-up from Swimming Cat Studios. I'm Doc Coleman, and I'm your host for this episode. Next up is another panel from Sunday, May 27th. This one was recorded at 7 p.m. and is entitled Homebrewing: How to Get Started and Excel at Making Your Own Craft Beer, Wine, and Etc. This was the second year for the homebrewing panel, led by John Taylor Williams and Thomas Gideon of the Living Proof Brewcast, which has recently rebranded itself as the Libation Liberation Front. Joining John and Thomas are fellow homebrewers Scott Roche and myself. If you've ever thought about making your own beer, wine, or hard cider, this episode will give you a lot of information about what you'll need to get started.
Thank you all very much for being here. I will start introductions to the far left. Doc Coleman, you have arrived. Please introduce yourself to panel.
Hi there. My name is Doc Coleman. I am a writer, a podcaster, a blogger, and I have made award-winning homebrew in my own kitchen.
Yes.
Been doing that for at least 10 years.
Fantastic. Thomas Gideon?
I'm Thomas Gideon for the purposes of this panel. I'm a home brewer, an award-winning mead maker. My beer has variously been distributed to the National Archives of the United States, to a bureau chief at C-SPAN, and with this man, one we collaborated on went to the permanent collections in the Smithsonian. You know, since we're bragging.
Yeah. My name is Scott Roche. I haven't won any awards, but I'm good anyway.
We think you can do it.
But I am a home brewer. I am a podcaster, I'm a writer, and an editor at Flying Island Press, a publishing company that puts out Flagship Magazine.
I am John Williams. I am a podcaster, co-host with Thomas on the Living Proof Brewcast, livingproofbrewcast.com. Audio engineer, AV multimedia producer, and I make beer because only I need to drink it. It's beautiful. Yes. You should give me your beer. Thank you all for being here, and we really appreciate your attention to homebrewing. How many of you in the room have homebrewed?
Oh,
that's nice. That's nice. How many of you intend to homebrew very shortly? Yes, beautiful.
Yes.
You have witnessed quite a lot of homebrewing because our good friend Chooch has come over for many a brew day. I guess I can we take it from the top? If I can give a quick definition of what homebrewing is, I think it's basically taking sugar and turning it into alcohol by introducing it to yeast and often bittering it with something like hops or other bittering herbs in order to kind of balance out that sugary sweetness and make it a little less cloying. Other than that, I think there really aren't any rules to homebrewing. Am I wrong? Does anyone want to argue that point?
There
are rules. Certain laws have been built over time in beer, but I think, my loosest definition is that sugar introduced to yeast turns into alcohol and carbon dioxide, and we drink what's left. Mm-hmm. Sugar derived from malt, yes. And although over time, well, beer, yes, yeah, mostly malted. Grains, yeah.
It kind of depends on whether you consider beer to be the product of a process or whether you consider beer to be a drink that is made with certain particular ingredients. I mean,
true.
Sake is made with sugars that are derived from rice.
Yes,
but it's the process is the beer brewing process.
I have a very very loose definition of beer, and there are definitely laws and definitions that are much more strict than mine. So.
It's all part of the joy of fermentation.
Mm-hmm. So where should we start? What is the actual name of this panel? Are we introduction to homebrew?
I think we were homebrewing 101.
Homebrewing 101.
Okay.
Awesome. That's the name of the panel.
Awesome.
It is now.
Okay. So, do we want to talk about the process? Should we start with the top?
Sure.
Okay. Take some grain and boil it.
No, I think we had this point of order last year. Maybe we should start from like
Please.
The simplest, easy way to get in. So yeah. if someone wants to talk okay. about extract brewing as a cost-effective,
that, yeah.
simpler process to get started with brewing before we jump into yeah. mashing and dealing with partial or all grain brewing.
So, okay. so this is my particular point of experience is the extract brewing. So basically what you have is the malt has already been prepared, usually into this sort of thick slurry. And you
or fine powder
or fine powder,
yeah. And really makes it very simple for the entry level brewer to make their first beers. So because you're just going to pour that into a certain amount of water, you're following a very specific recipe, and it's almost like making a cake mix. Really, it's that mm-hmm. simple. So you're pouring the ingredients into boiling water. You're cooking it for a certain period of time. Bittering agents either at the point of boil, during the boil, after the boil, depending on what kind of beer you're making.
Or all three of the above.
All three of the above in some cases. And then when it's gotten cool, after you boil it for a certain period of time, you let it cool to roughly room temperature.
Right.
And then you pitch your yeast, which is just putting the yeast in liquid, and you put it into a fermenting vessel. In my case, that's a glass carboy, which is basically just a glass water cooler sort of mm-hmm. container, putting an airlock on it, which lets the stuff out and doesn't let anything in. The
gases escape, but not yes. nothing else to.
Yep. And then after 2 to 4 weeks, maybe a bit longer, depending on what beer you're making, you would then bottle it, and in my case, and let it condition, get the nice bubbles, and mm-hmm. taste yummy, and you drink it.
Yay.
So it really is. At the entry level, it really is very simple. The key to that whole process turning out well, typically, is sanitization. Mm. That's uh-huh. probably the most key thing to do.
The three most key things to do. Okay. Sanitize, right. sanitize,
sanitize. Sanitize, sanitize, sanitize. Yeah. Medication. Yeah. Please, please, question?
In all of that situation right there,
yeah.
could you do it in your garage?
Say sure.
Hmm?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah,
75 yeah. is a little hot because, but depending on the yeast, yeast is temperature sensitive, and that's why you want to cool after your boil anyway to bring it down. You're cooling the wort, which is unfermented beer. You're cooling it only to bring it down low enough that the yeast can survive that initial pitching. Because if you threw the yeast into a boiling kettle, they would just kind of scream and die.
Same thing would happen if I threw you into a boiling kettle.
Let's talk a little bit about the yeast. There are two major.
Perfect. Yes.
There's lots of different varietals of yeast.
Thousands of different varietals, yeah.
They come into two major categories. That's ale yeast and lager yeast. And the one of the main determining characteristics between the two is the band of temperature where they survive.
Yeah.
So no lagering for you.
No lagering in your garage. You'll use an ale yeast in the garage. Essentially, and 75 is sort of like your upper limit of temperature. You want to go 75 and
unless.
Below. But lagering yeast also ferments from the bottom, and ale yeast always ferments from the top. So it ale yeast sits at the top of the slurry of wort and chews from the top and poops out carbon dioxide and farts out
delicious alcohol.
Yeah. So but there's also one odd caveat, which of course is off tangent, is California steam yeast. So like Anchor Steam beer is made with a form of lagering yeast that has been over time bred to be more temperature resistant and can be.
I want to generalize.
Please.
I want to generalize that a little bit. It's worth noting there are always exceptions, and we could bog down a lot on this panel on exceptions. So, I mean, if we have a lot of time for questions, we can really dig into like high temperature ferments. Mm-hmm. The Belgian yeast in particular do well with that. But it's probably worth sticking to more like the general classes.
We're all nerds about this.
Your most approachable way to start is mm-hmm. is like Scott mentioned. Start with using extracts in order to get your fermentable sugars, and use an ale yeast because you don't have to cool down as much. It's got a slightly hardier range of temperatures that it works in.
And most of your stouts and your porters and your
those are all ales.
So you can do a wide variety of beers.
How consistent is the temperature in your garage? Because I find that temperature consistency is perhaps more important than.
Consistent, I might stay away from doing it during the hottest.
There's one thing I'll recommend that I have done that's a really great thing if you're renting and you've been there a while, you expect to be there a while, if you own your own home, is to get a 24-hour thermometer and set mm-hmm. that up and just set up a simple spreadsheet and just track temperatures, highs and lows, over the course of several months. You can do it continuously throughout a single year, or you can just cherry pick like the most extreme months for a given season. And that'll actually give you a really nice curve to let you know that you have a very stable temperature in the environment where you would do the actual fermenting.
Yeah.
And then you wouldn't have, I think, as many problems with a stalled fermentation mm-hmm. or with those wild temperature variations causing problems.
I don't want to get too deep on this right away.
You don't necessarily have to store, when you're storing it for fermentation, that doesn't necessarily have to be where you're brewing it. So you can go out and brew in your garage and then
bring it in and store it
someplace, store it
in
a
closet. Yeah.
Good point. Or someplace like good that, point, someplace yeah. with
brew,
nice.
Brew it out in a garage is fine.
A lot of yeah. people do that, especially if you're using propane as your heat source.
Like a turkey,
a
like a
yeah.
turkey.
Yeah. Do it outside.
Okay, yeah. We had a question
here and here. So you first, please. Yes. 65 and.
I thought it was 55.
I'm sorry. I mess with those damn Cali lagers. It's hard to do lagers in a home brewing environment
without
unless you refrigerate or winter
yeah.
in your basement or something like that. So you're right. It is around the 55 range. Yeah. The Cali lagers, you can get away and you can cheat it at about 65 degrees. So all the lagers I've ever made at home, I've used the California Y yeast, and the two, there's White Labs and Y yeast mm-hmm. to make the most, probably the easiest to get yeast around, like you can order from them and you can order different varietals of yeast. So
basically, if you're going to do lagering, you live in an area where you have like a really cold, really stable basement, or you're talking about buying a specific refrigerator for putting your fermenters when you're lagering. And mm-hmm. that may be just
yes.
an extra refrigerator you buy and punch a hole through the top so that
yeah.
the CO2 that comes out the airlock will come out of the fridge. Otherwise, the fridge will open up with CO2, and you could possibly open that fridge and knock yourself out.
Over the winter, it's the opposite.
Yeah.
You might put it to sleep. You might put the yeast to sleep. Literally, all we're doing is hurting yeast.
But
all right?
people who
right
are really into
it.
Lagering will build their own refrigerated
yes,
section of their garage
and
that's temperature controlled.
A quick point, and then I want to take your question. A quick point is the difference between ales and lagers is that lagers tend to be smoother, and they take longer to both ferment, mm-hmm. and they take longer to sort of bottle condition. Mm-hmm. So they're slower moving yeast. They tend to be smoother in their final flavor profile. The ales are a little sharper, a little more aggressive, and they're quicker to both ferment, and then they're quicker to bottle temperature condition.
I have a two-part.
Yes. The second is a big debate. I don't think there's an advantage except for long-term storage. Glass is better. I prefer plastic because I use a lot
it's
of
cheaper.
Ales. It's cheaper.
Yeah,
it's easier
to
clean because it's almost like a dry food grade plastic drywall bucket. Really easy to clean out. The carboys are a little harder to mm-hmm. clean out. Their mead makers tend to start with and stay with glass because when
doesn't
you make
scratch.
Mead, you're talking about being an hour in. A year of fermentation to sort of get yourself to a finished mead. Whereas with beer, you can be finished yeah. in
if
like
the,
a month.
If the plastic
month
scratches over time, it will scratch from that cleaning, no matter how careful
yes.
you are. And those micro scratches are places where
germs,
other organisms and germs
other
can accumulate, no
it,
matter how fastidious you are. So there's
yeah.
there's a limited lifetime where you'll have to replace your plastic
yeah.
buckets.
Yeah.
But they're cheap enough that I think John's main point is right, is that it's roughly break even, and it's really kind of, what's your situation? What do you start with? What's your preference?
Real quick, Doc, before I forget, the first one on the yeast, you think about the temperature?
I believe, if my memory serves me correctly, about the lowest temperature that you will still get fermentation from a lager yeast is either like 45 or 40 degrees
yeah, and you're
Fahrenheit.
You're right at the edge of
and
slipping
it may depend
into
on the varietal.
Stalled. You don't want to stall your fermentation
yeah.
because if you do, bad things happen and other bacteria will take over. Your main point, I mean, again, like I said about herding yeast, you're literally trying to create the a I mean, yeast is going to attack a sugar water and turn it into a fermentated a ferment.
But it's not the only thing.
Right,
other
but it's not the only
thing.
And your point
and they
is,
don't
is
produce
that
as drinkable
you're basically trying to set up the perfect environment for fermentation and then throw the yeast of your intention at it and keep everything else away from it so that it can take hold and build a colony. It's like a space colony. We're in a science fiction convention.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like
now,
a space
now,
colony.
Now, ironically, if you want to talk about what is the best material for a fermentation vessel, pretty much the industry agrees that stainless steel is your best fermentation vessel. However, stainless steel fermentals are incredibly expensive. You can get them if you have – once you have cultivated your enjoyment of home brewing to the
point
that this is going to be your lifelong calling.
You can get into this very cheap or you can spend a ton of money. It depends. And I guess it depends on your dedication to it or how much you want to push out, how much you are what kind of odd things you want to do with beer. So you can start really – I think you can start pretty cheap, $100
or
so.
My kit, was approximately $100 and that gave me everything except – the ingredients and the bottles.
Actually, my kit was $100, and it included the ingredients for the first batch of beer, but not the bottles.
Yeah, that's an important point. A lot of the homebrew supply stores that are opening now will sell prepackaged kits that have a particular – so you have a particular beer you want to make. Yeah. They'll sell you all the ingredients, and as a starter, at somewhat of a discount, they'll sell you all of the basic equipment that you need to get started. And that's a pretty good deal when you can find that, when you can go
and
to
that
local.
And that included the bottle cap or two, which is a
– Yeah.
I think realistically, a decent starter kit with ingredients, you're talking about $150. But you with that kit, your first beer, we're talking about five – for those who don't know, we're talking about 5-gallon vessels for the most part. So five gallons equals a little bit more, a little bit less than 2 cases of beer. Mm-hmm. So – $50 worth of ingredients to make 2 cases of really good beer. If you see beer prices, I mean, sure, you can go out and get Bud Light and the 12 packs for next to nothing. But to make a really good beer, you can make a really expensive barley wine for $50-$60. The most expensive beer supply-wise alone, just the ingredients for the beer, was probably my Greengrass and High Tides stale vatted IPA, which is sort of like a really sticky, really imperial IPA with all
a crap ton,
all like tons, like
that's
11
a term of
ounces
art,
of East Kent
of
Golding hops.
That's
right?
A technical measure.
And,
yes,
and crap ton is a technical measure. And because
half
those hops
ton,
are so expensive, because they're
ton,
noble hops,
double crap ton.
What is that in metric?
It was about $75, but I made 2 cases of beer that was.
Am I moderating this panel?
No.
Sorry.
Are you?
I'm not. You're
sabotaging it.
We've been wondering that over here. But.
Yeah. You're doing fine.
I think that's deserved.
Sorry, Jonathan. It's been a long day.
I know. And I love
And I may not drink for a living, sir.
But there's a
you,
lot of
sir,
beer passion
certainly not a
here.
Hobo.
But I'm certainly not a hobo.
Sorry. Any questions real quick? And we've gone fast and over. Oh, you first think, Kevin.
Brown.
Brown glass.
Brown. Yes, that's true. Yes, brown.
Not
twist top. Yeah. Thank you. That's why you get more beer.
We're very picky.
That's correct.
Embossed.
Yeah, I don't like that. I don't like embossing. I mean, so it's up to you, okay?
Yeah.
And to be honest with you,
so we know where to send our rejects, our orphaned beer bottles.
I've grown lazy, and I actually do a lot of bottling just in growlers, which are the big liter bottles. I pour them full and snap the lid on, and I usually wrap that with saran wrap to double check that it stays airtight. Yeah, because I mean, it's already snapped down, but you can sometimes the wire can get.
And some people like swing top bottles, so you can usually find
like
16 ounce
style bottles, but brown.
Rich. Yeah,
and the reason, please tell them
the 16 ounce swing top bottles that basically have a wire cage on the top and a little ceramic nut and a rubber gasket. And one of the fun things about those is sometimes we haven't gotten to bottling yet, but one of the last steps before you put it in bottle is you add a little bit more sugar to your fermented beer so that while the beer is in the bottle, the yeast will generate
that final
just
snack.
A little bit more carbon dioxide that's trapped in the bottle, and that carbonates your beer. Now, the neat thing about the swing top bottles with the rubber gasket is that sometimes you pitch a little bit too much sugar by accident. If you do that with something that you've capped, there's the possibility that you will end up with bottle bombs.
Yes.
Where you basically stress stressed the glass as much as it can take, and
you will have a lot of sticky sugar all over your storage
and shards of glass.
If you overpressurize it, they'll blow up in the case. If you have just barely hit that edge, you'll end up picking up a bottle and tapping it against something, and then it will blow up. Or when you go to pop the top, it'll blow up, or it'll fountain across the room. So bottle bombs are bad.
Yeah, none of that.
But the great thing about the flip top bottles is because of that rubber gasket, you will never have bottle bombs you will almost never have bottle bombs. You're the only person I've heard of.
The reason I added is because a friend of mine did give me a bunch of the Grolsch bottles, mm-hmm. and there must have been a weakness around the bottom of the bottle because mm-hmm. it blew out the bottom.
And okay. Explain the reason for brown. Or Thomas.
No, I wanted to interject first that we obsess about bottle bombs because it's a horrible waste of beer.
Yes.
In my experience, it happens, but it's not ridiculously common. If you pay good attention to your recipes and you develop good heuristics for your priming sugar,
I think the thing you should most worry about is sanitation. And we'll talk about when sanitation is most important and when it's not really that important at all to lessen the fear that you can mess up, because you really can't mess it up. You can kind of get in the way if you're not careful. And the reason bottles should be brown the reason bottles should be brown is because hops are photosensitive and they'll skunk. So the beers that taste skunked, actually brown bottles don't eliminate all sunlight, but they filter out most of the sunlight that skunks your.
If you can do cans, great.
Well, cans are actually making a huge resurgence in craft beer. Aluminum bottles are great. I think that's great. They're completely sunproof.
If you want your beer to end up tasting like Heineken, by all means, put it in a green bottle.
Yeah,
I personally would
like that. Taste like, if you like skunky beer, green bottles are fantastic.
Yeah, next time you're at a beer store, go walk around the imports, and it's like every time you see a clear or green bottle, this is a country that hates us.
Yes.
Because they make really good beer and they put it into skunk me now bottles.
Yeah.
And
I love Newcastle, but a Newcastle sitting in the front window, stay away from it. I mean, if you can get fresh tasting keg Newcastle, it's wonderful.
But it's basically that the certain wavelengths of light will cause the chemicals from the hops
phenols
to break down and ruin the taste of the beer.
Yeah.
Is there, before we take questions, is there anything we're missing? Should we talk about the process from the beginning? Oh,
let's
sorry, Kevin.
Kevin
had
Kevin
a question.
First and then.
Okay. Apartment brewing is a very valid. There's a segment of people who do apartment home brewing. You can actually do the brewing in your kitchen.
I brew in my kitchen every time.
We did kind of gloss over this, but typically your batch of beer is a 5 gallon batch.
Doesn't have to be that.
But you don't have to do a 5 gallon batch.
Do
the other thing is
or
that
one or
yeah.
Ten.
No, I know, where, I know where you're going here, Doc.
As big or as small as you want. The other thing is you're not always boiling 5 gallons of wort at the same time. A lot of beginners start off, they will
partial volume.
A nice chili
do partial
pot.
Boil.
A nice chili pot, a nice soup.
You'll
vessel.
Boil maybe 2 gallons
for
months, of water. And then
introduce your hops.
What I would do when I was doing partial boils is I would boil 2 gallons with the malt and the hops, and then I would seed a gallon of clean water into the fermenter. Then I would take it hot from the oven, pour it into the fermenter, and then add the other 2 gallons of water. And usually in the process of doing that, I've cooled it down to the point where I can pitch my yeast.
Yes.
So pros and cons of partial boils. Pros are usually by the time you've got everything up to your actual fermentation volume, you've hit your temperature to pitch your yeast. The cons are a lot of people feel that because you're trying to dissolve the sugars and the more importantly,
hops.
The hops
yes.
into a smaller volume of water, you're not going to get as good an extraction, so you're not going to get as much flavor.
Not as efficient of an extraction, and the less, at some point, you'll reach saturation level. So if the more you can keep throwing hops at it, and you won't go beyond a certain amount.
Personally, if I were in your shoes, what I would do is, and I recommended this to a friend of mine, he's had good success, get a Mr. Beer kit.
Mm-hmm. They just got bought by a new owner that's actually upgrading the kits.
That gives you a one-gallon fermentation vessel.
Yes.
Everything that you're going to do is going to be on the one-gallon scale. It's really easy to store and clean and do all the stuff that you need to do in an apartment. And the fun thing about doing gallon batch sizes is it allows you more opportunity for variety.
You're paying one-fifth the amount for ingredients right off the top.
Yeah, so I mean, I make 5 gallon beer. I've got to make it pretty much
the same thing.
And if you mess up, you mess up five gallons
of beer.
There's tricks to that too, though. You can brew 5 gallons, and when you split it out, you can do different things.
Another thing you can do is you can brew with a friend.
Yeah.
I've done American Homebrewers Day. Another brewer and I got together on a stout recipe, and then we split the batch in half. Mm-hmm. And he took his half, and I don't know exactly what he did with it. I took my half, and I let it ferment for a couple of weeks, and then I threw raspberries into it. I made a lovely raspberry stout. Mm-hmm. That becomes problematic in getting because I also ended up with all this raspberry gunk on the bottom. But we'll go in. That's an advanced technique that we'll go into a little bit later. But if you've got a closet in your apartment that is that consistent temperature and has decent ventilation, and you can clear out space to put your fermenter in that closet, that's good. Because when you're fermenting, you can put the fermenter in there, and then you pull it out, take it back into your kitchen where you've got all your bottles ready. You transfer it from the fermenter into your bottling bucket with your sugar. You bottle, you cap, you put them in your case boxes, you put it back in that closet. You probably won't be doing heel and toe batches or multiple batches at the same time, but an apartment brewer can brew very easily as long as you've got that space that you can store it that's at a nice constant temperature. Mm-hmm.
Here first and then Viv. Sorry.
You were talking about the water. Do you usually use distilled water or tap water?
Ice tap water.
Yeah.
Water does, to back away from my loosely defined
object of beer. It depends on your
beer.
Tap water.
Yes. Yeah.
And to back off of what I said of my loosely defined concept of beer, which is sugar, yeast, water, and hops or bittering agents. I mean, literally, certain beers prefer certain alkaline levels for the water. For example, not so much IPAs, but some of the Pilsners want certain levels of.
Let's do the simple rule of thumb. If you enjoy drinking your tap water, you will enjoy drinking beer made from your tap water.
Well put.
Chlorine
sort of boils out.
Yeah, it comes out with the CO2.
Some of the most impressive craft beers in the country actually use their municipal city water. New Belgium actually use rainwater collected from their cisterns on the roofs.
Now, if you really want to get into it, there are PhD programs based around choosing water for brewing.
True in a lot of distillants, too.
It's incredibly complex science at that level. But again, the rule of thumb is if you enjoy your water, you will enjoy your beer.
Like the cool Rocky Mountain spring water of Coors Beer.
Yeah, comes from the tap.
Viv?
I wanted to ask a question for anybody else in the room that hasn't heard about other tracks, which is, what if I share a house or share a budget with someone that is not into home brewing? How can I get them to be accepting of it? You know, because I've heard that answer for podcasting. How can you answer that for home brewing?
The big problem is, do they have a problem with the smell of boiling wort?
Yeah, the smell is tough for some people. To me, I love the smell of boiled or heated grains, sugar extracted grains.
I would say that it's the smell is actually very pleasant.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's a personal taste thing. Some people love share it. Your some beer people with them. Can't stand it.
it's still pleasant.
Yeah. And as far as the budgetary concerns go, you know, most of my homebrewing was done when I was the sole income provider of a large family, and you know, I just told my wife, you know, look, not that she was really objecting, but I wanted to lay it out for her. You know, I'm drinking beer right now, and if I make my own, I will be paying less than I am paying now. Yeah. You know, in my case, my kit was given to me as a birthday present, so the only cost I had in it was the cost of the ingredients. Yeah. So, you know, it makes sense from a
monetary
perspective too.
Economically, it's really great because it's like you said, just about everything you use is reusable. Sunk cost, your only expense is bottle caps, and if you use flip tops, you don't have to worry about that. Sanitizing chemicals and the actual ingredients.
And which you can also reuse and recycle.
Yes.
John is very fastidious about mulching his spent grains. Yeah. We have a beautiful recipe from a brewmaster friend of ours in Gaithersburg for spent grain bread that's delicious. Yeah. We just haven't figured out how to scale it down because we're both idiots at math from
if you're
a
doing
50x batch to
if you're doing extract, then you don't have that.
I don't think we put that recipe online. We haven't put
I would just want to check. I know Brett's very sharing, but he's just want to check with him first before
essentially though,
he gave it to us.
It's part of about half of the flour that you would make for bread. You comes from the spent grains, and the rest comes from like refined flour, and you make it like you would make a regular bread. It's fantastic. I mean, it's like making your own homemade whole grain bread, and you get, because you can't really pull out all of the sugar from the grain. You're left with the sweetness that's beautiful. So the bread tastes very beautiful. I mean, can we step back for just a second real quick, like, and talk about grain? Because I mean, we've talked about extracted grain, but all that is essentially grain that's already had the sugar extracted from it and collected. So
I think we kind of got to the part where the next step is actually to talk about partial mashing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a good point.
And so now is a good time to bring in. Let me just quick. Partial mashing is where part of your fermentables come from extract can, and the rest is done with grain that you actually add.
That's correct. So. That's correct. Thomas, can you talk about that a little bit? Because there's two kinds of
the problem with extracts are that someone else has already done the mash conversion. So they've already. So to back up a little bit into the kind of the science behind this, malted barley is barley kernels that have been force germinated and then kilned. So it starts to release the...
almost like making sprouts, and then you suspend them.
Yeah, right? Mm-hmm. And it starts to release the amylase enzymes, and there are two different varieties of that convert the starch in the malt kernel into sugars that the growing plant can access. Those are the sugars we want to make beer.
Yes.
When you then take that halted germination, and you add water and you add heat, reactivates those enzymes and they start to convert that starch again. So with extract, somebody else has done that. And then
done
they'll
it in
centrifuge
advance.
It out, or they'll boil, reduce it down to a syrup or to a powder. Even with partial, where you're doing maybe a quarter to a half of your sugar from malted barley, you have a greater selection of grains, far more specialty grains. Mm-hmm. You have more temperature control because the two different enzymes activate at different temperatures. So you have a few more variables, a few more knobs, if you will,
so this
you can
is important
start to affect for flavor.
This is important for a couple reasons. First off, you get rid of the flat and lack of variety. But most important, think about grains a lot like coffee, right? You have multiple types of roasting. And in the process, and it's an art form of itself, the actual germinating and the building of barley, roasting of barley is its own art form that's done before we get to it. And there's some homebrewers who are crazy enough to actually do that as well. But so you have things that are, you know, you make your stouts, you have very roasted chocolate and black patent malt barley that have been really roasted hard. So you're pulling from them very roasty, dark, smoky flavors versus very pale malted things, which give you a lot of sugars. And there's also crystal malts, which are great for partial malt.
I love crystal malt.
Crystal malts are fantastic because they've been the sugar already crystallized and ready to be used. So it doesn't take a whole lot of temperature playing that Thomas is talking about. And you have to think, too, about sugar in multiple ways, too. All sugars aren't created equal. Some sugars, yeast, like, say, white processed sugar, yeast will basically eat it and turn it into pure alcohol and leave nothing behind. So it'll be very hot. It'll be very alcohol with no real flavor left over. So it's actually unsweetened at the end of the process. Crap loads of sugar at the end of the process. It's all alcohol and no sweetness, right? You want body. You want roundness in beers. You want to try it. So there's other sugars that are more complex sugars that the yeast have a hard time chewing on. So they eat what they can and they leave the rest. So at the end of the day, they've left behind a whole bunch of weird adjuncts and flavor profiles and compounds that you have the ability to sort of, over time, as you go from extract into partial grain to all grain brewing, you're learning the process of designing a beer from scratch and figuring out, well, I like something really sweet, or I like something really tart, or I like something really hoppy, or something really brown and molasses, and what things you can add into it.
There's a couple of terms when we get into grain that we'll add into the mix of things that we've been talking about. We'll talk about the mashing process. That's where you add the water and the heat to the malted barley to start that starch conversion. You have lautering, which is the separation of the wort.
Washing the sugars out of the grain.
Yeah. And sparging is generally done along with lautering. And there are multiple techniques for lautering and for sparging. And there are divisive debates about which is best, but I think really it's based on your taste, your experience, or maybe the particular beer that you're after. Experimentation, that's one thing that I think when you start to get into even partial grain, adding those variables gives you a greater space of experimentation, a lot more things you can try.
Yeah. Yeah. There's absolutely a ton of things that you can play. Just look at the styles of beer out there, and all of those are basically tweaks on the same handful of ingredients. So you can endlessly experiment with things.
Well, I love wine. Wine is fantastic, but it's very tied to terroir. It's very tied to these grapes
beer
from this piece
terroir.
Of grain. What's that?
Beer has terroir.
Beer has terroir, yeah.
It has much more terroir because all of the ingredients can have. We were talking about
each
earlier.
Each ingredient has its own
terroir.
We
haven't gotten into hop varieties. Yeah. Certain hops only grow in certain regions.
Right.
And those can have a terroir, and they can change from year to year.
And different kinds of hops have different qualities,
but
how the hops are processed.
Yeah. To John's point, on top of that, in addition to that, there are so many more different processes involved and variables involved than with mead making and wine making.
We haven't really even talked about hops so much, but there are multiple different hops that you can use in beer, multiple varieties of hops, like multiple varieties of yeast and multiple varieties of barley roasts and two row versus six row, all of that, and water. But the hops themselves, it depends on, usually you boil for about 60 minutes, sometimes 90 minutes, but on average you boil your wort for 60 minutes, and depending on when you put the hops in depends on what the hops give you on the other end. So you can use multiple different hops, or you can actually take the same hop. If you put it in the kettle at the beginning of the boil, it creates bitter. If you put it in, say, at the 30 minute or 10 minute mark, it creates flavor. And if you put it in 10 minutes out or right as the boil ends, it creates aroma. So you can take the same hop and spread it out throughout the whole process, put certain amount here, certain amount here, certain amount here, or just all at the front end, and it will give you a different character. So that's what I mean, more
or,
like
or you can use a different hop for each thing.
That's exactly right. A bittering hop at the front and then an aroma hop for more floral and sweetness at the end. So
if you've seen what we call smash beers, and they're not usually labeled as
they usually will
have the name of the hop very prominent. We had one that we found locally here. Mm-hmm. It's a Seattle beer, but we don't get it down county in Montgomery County, that was highlighting the Sauvin hop.
Yes.
So if you find like Simcoe, Seneca, you know, a hop name, a recognizable hop name.
Willamette.
Mm-hmm. On the beer label, odds are that's a single hop varietal beer. And to John's point, they've used that for bittering, for flavor, for aroma. And that's a good way to get a sense of what those ingredients
and
can do.
Ultimately, if I can get back, one of the benefits of brewing your own beer is that it opens your appreciation. but it opens your appreciation for what other people are doing in the beer that they make. So when you crack open a beer, it's like opening a novel that someone's really crafted a certain way, and it gives you the ability to sort of see how the mechanics of and appreciate the mechanics of how they came about,
and then
that.
Figure out how to do it yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. You can reverse engineer.
You can either figure out how to replicate somebody else's beer, or you could say, you know, this beer would be a little bit better if it just had more of this.
And there's
and
plenty
then go
of books
make
out
that
there.
Yourself.
There's plenty of books out there that are clone recipe books that can give you. And I think that's a great way to start too. Like recipe kits are out there that emulate a certain beer that you already know and like, and it gives you a good starting point as a reference. Go ahead.
While I'm not moderating this panel, I would like to say that we have not
10
talked
minutes.
At all
I believe in anarchy.
About sanitization.
Cool. Yeah.
In detail. And
sure.
I think that we need to give a few minutes to that.
Please, that would be fantastic.
Given its importance. Yeah. We did say it was important, and then we didn't really explain why.
Yeah. The most important thing that was pointed out to me when I first started was clean and sanitary are not necessarily the same thing.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So you need to clean all of your equipment, soap and water.
Clean all of your kitchen or
rinse
your garage.
The soap
or your...
thoroughly.
Thoroughly. Yeah.
Detergents will affect head formation and retention. Get them out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And clean your area.
Mm-hmm.
And then you need to sanitize particularly things like the bottles, the spoons, any of the hardware that you're using.
The fermentation vessel itself.
The fermentation vessel. Anything that the beer is going to touch or that is going to touch the beer.
After the boil.
The boil is a very clean kitchen and you want a very clean pot. You don't. But the boil is going to kill off anything before you get. Put the wort, unfermented wort, that is by far the most treacherous and dangerous of time.
The most dangerous time for your beer is when you turn that heat off on your stove or whatever kind of stove.
Absolutely.
And from there until you actually get the yeast into it and the yeast starts going.
Yeah.
Which is why there's a lot of debate also, and there are a lot of techniques for cooling. So you can start like what Doc described, very, very simple.
Brilliant way to cool fast.
Boil and using the ambient temperature of your water addition. You can use ice. You can add a little salt to your ice with a larger, like I have a galvanized tub that I use. And you can get immersion chillers, and you can get super fancy that are essentially refrigeration coils you dip into or you run the wort through.
Let's not say refrigeration coils, because refrigeration coils are usually put together with solder, and that will dissolve into your beer. But
so
it's
copper
tubing in a coil that you go ahead and stick in your wort and run cold water through it.
Right. Any questions? That's fantastic. And we should mention first off, there's sanitizers and sterilizers. I would say one of the most popular sanitizers is B-Brite, which is a form of almost like an oxygenated bleach. So B-Brite is, I bought my first batch of B-Brite 5 years ago now, and I still have more than enough because it just dissolves.
It lasts forever.
I use my, and for we haven't even really gotten into bottling. Bottling, basically you're going to ferment your beer for a good week, 2 weeks or 3 weeks or whatnot, you're going to check your alcohol level to see if it's fermented as much as you want. Then you're going to bottle it. And you basically have to bottle with a bucket that has a hole in it with a tap, and you're going to bottle in front of you. I love bottling in front of my dishwasher. I take all of my bottles. I clean them out really good. I put them in the dishwasher. I put them on their hottest setting. I run the dishwasher with just bottles in it. I have a squeeze bottle, spray bottle full of B-Brite and water solution. And I plop the bottling bucket on top of my dishwasher counter, on the counter in front of my dishwasher. I take a little stool. I pull the dishwasher door down. I spray all of the bottles out and let them dry while they're still in there. I spray off the whole inside of the dishwasher. And I have a hose that comes off of the siphoning thing, and a little bottling wand, which is basically just like a long...
Coolest thing ever.
It's great. it's literally like a long clear tube with a spring and a little tap at the bottom. And you push it down until it touches the bottom of the bottle, and the bottle starts filling up with beer. When you get to the top, you lift it up off the bottom. It stops it. You pull that wand out, and you have exactly enough room left for air to make room for gas, because you're going to... when you go to bottle, you're going to add extra sugar, as Doc was saying, right then and there. That extra sugar at the end, 2 weeks after the beer's been fermented, you're putting it into the bottle, you add a little bit of extra sugar, maybe half a cup, a cup of sugar, dissolved in water, mixed into the beer. That gives the yeast a little wake-up snack, and it wakes up. And unlike before, where you're letting the beer outgas into the air, so all the carbon dioxide goes in the air and the alcohol builds up in the beer itself, that now that you seal it in the bottle, where does the carbon dioxide have to go? It can't pop out of the bottle. It infuses itself back into the beer, and that's what forms your carbonation.
One thing to point out, if you're using the dishwasher to sanitize your bottles, do not use Jet Dry. The chemicals in Jet Dry that prevent spots cover the inside of the dishwasher.
It's a surfactant.
They cover the inside of the dishwasher, and they will wash from the dishwasher surface into your bottles, and that will kill the head on your beer. So if you have been using Jet Dry and you want to use your dishwasher, you've got to run it for at least a couple weeks to get rid of the residue.
You might have a problem because you spray your bottles with Be-Brite.
The Be-Brite might help by washing the surface.
Yeah, I would say
Jet Dry. Here and then there.
Yes, right. Good point.
I can see that. Mm-hmm. I can see that. That's good.
I haven't had a problem with that either. You run an extra rinse cycle and you always squirt
it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Extra rinse cycle is the difference.
Yeah.
Right. When you're using it to actually wash the bottles. Right. I think the most important thing, and the dishwasher is sort of just a side note anyway, because you can really just wash bottles out, hang them to dry, and then spray them with Be-Brite if you do it well enough. I think the most important thing about the dishwasher is that you get that little heated dry at the end. That you're washing the inside, that you've already cleaned these bottles really well to begin with. You pop them in the dishwasher for an additional cleaning. So I would think either or. And I would think even with detergent, I've done detergent, it hasn't bothered mine, but I think that's because I spray it with Be-Brite before I put beer in. Be-Brite is food safe. It's like an oxygenated bleach.
You don't have to wash it off.
It does a final clean out and coating of the bottle that's food safe and not doesn't affect the beer. But I think the thing I like about using the dishwasher is that I'll put it on heated, dry, and then it just brings the bottles up way high in temperature, and then I let them cool down a little bit. But it's sort of an extra guarantee that you're not gonna.
You can't overdo.
Yeah, you can't overdo
cleaning or sanitization.
Yeah.
Second row.
Well,
here?
No, you can't.
Yes. If you don't mind, depending on the amount of unfermentable wheat, so let's say you're going to make a barley wine, which is a big beer, a 12% to 15 to 18, some even higher percent alcohol by volume beer. It takes a lot of sugar to make a lot of alcohol, right? And the more sugar you have, the more unfermentable sugar you have. And the more unfermentable sugar you have, the sweeter that beer is ultimately going to be. So to balance that sweet, so the beer isn't so cloying, you want to add more bittering agents. Now, it's done in a lot of different ways. Hops have become, over time, we have 5 minutes left to get into historical reasons for that. But you add more hops or more bittering agents to counterbalance the sweet. I love different spices like cardamom. I love cardamom in a stout. I mean, it's very, so think of beer as a food that's in liquid form. It's literally like a way to contain beer. So if you can cook with it, you can make it. Chili beers are fantastic. Yeah. With moles, chocolate. We've used cocoa nibs. We've used tons of different herbs and please, oregano, basil. Yep. It is.
Yes.
It is. True. When you're cooking bitter, Yep. That's a good point. You can also think some of the malts are bitter, like the chocolate malts, the patent malts. They have their own roast smoke flavor that yeah. gives them bitter.
I mean, there have been a variety of herbs good used point, over the over time, but pretty much hop. Once people started using hops, it was such an effective bittering agent that gave good control that everyone went to using it. Before that, while people were still looking for good bittering agents, they would actually do beer that wasn't bittered. So it would come out very sweet, and they would eat it with things like they'd eat radishes and other bitter vegetables like that while drinking it in order to balance the flavors.
If,
yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Many times. Yeah.
If you.
Right. I think anything yes. you can think of, there's total room for it. I absolutely agree. I think making beer as if it's food. One last question, and we got to. Thank you.
Yes. If you search for the term gruet, G-R-U-E-T, I think that's the right yep. spelling. I-T. Thank
mm-hmm.
you.
G-R-U-I-T. Uh-huh.
See, I haven't seen it written. I've only heard it. If you search for that term, G-R-U-I-T, you'll find a good amount of material about non-hop beers. And, yeah, that's one of the problems with the gruit is it's not as shelf-stable as a
the reason
beer.
They call an Indian Pale Ale was made by the British Army when they were in India. They wanted beer, and they found that it wouldn't store well getting there. So they put extra hops in it. So that's why when we drink IPAs, we know that they're bittered with hops because the hops were the preservative that allowed them to transport it that far. And then the British Army found a hankering for that bitterness. And when they came home, they demanded more of it. So they kept making
it. If I can make one last statement about please. Drink by dates. You see that on a lot of commercial beers, drink it by so-and-so. One, that's a way to get you to buy more beer. Two, their beers really will go bad quickly because they've been filtered to remove all the yeast. Your homebrew will last a lot longer because you've still got
it's still alive.
Not dead yeast, but drowsy yeast is still advancing the flavor profile of your beer, and your beer can last several years and continue to improve the flavor profile before that starts to descend because the yeast gets too old.
Go ahead.
Nutraceuticals.
Yeah.
I so wish we had more time to talk, and thank you all so much for coming out. I think our clock is up. livingproofbrewcast.com here.
ScottRoche.com.
And DocColeman.com.
Thank you all so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Oh, do we have to get started?
We can start early. Yeah, we'll be fine. When Doc gets here, we'll.
Oh, that's right.
We'll point and laugh.
We're waiting for the fourth horseman.
We got a minute.
Apocalypse.
One minute. Is everyone cool? Just settle in. Settle in. We're gonna be fine. This is gonna be good.
Are you moderating this show?
I am, and I'm wrangling you. You have one more minute before you can be
unwrangled. It's not like you have a year and a half experience now running your own podcast.
Wrangling cats.
They
picked a poor person to actually do the moderation because you're the one who always brings us back to topic. I'm the one who always takes us off of topic.
I prefer stir frying cats.
Sorry.
How do you know unless you tried?
Gut reaction.
That was like
scandalous.
A
note to self.
Yes, he's here. There we go. Look at like clockwork.
Here
like a clockwork cabaret, ladies and gentlemen, Doc Coleman. Yes, I am wrangling cats today, so today is my turn. So.
Yeah,
wrangling cats all day
don't make
long.
Stir-frying cat jokes.
And PG Rods, thank you.
Just meow. A fair warning.
All right, well, we are recording.